It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. We are finally getting Major League games to watch, and there's a lot to talk about. So it's going to be a bit of a rapid-fire version of the Fantasy 411 today, so let's get right to it. We start with the Yankees closer situation. There is a much bigger issue at play here, but that is not what we talk about here. We're here to talk about fantasy baseball, so we are going to do that. Given that Aroldis Chapman will be missing, suspended for the first 30 games of the year, he will be available for 132 games instead of 162. Fred, how does that affect how you look at him, how you evaluate him on draft day?
Yeah, and it's different than an injury, you know, where if a player was going to miss the first 30 games with an injury and then you worry about a recurrence or setback, we don't have to worry about that in this case. To me, it knocks him out of the top tier of closers and kind of puts him in that second tier. I think he's still a top 10 closer. You know, he gets 30 saves and the ratios will be terrific. We just have to, you're going to have to wait a little longer because he won't get 40 saves. That's highly, highly unlikely. You know, I don't think he can be in the top five closers anymore.
And then the other part of that is, what does it do to your view on Andrew Miller? Andrew Miller probably goes from somebody who you might think would pick up three or four saves over the course of the year to somebody who might be more like 10 over the course of the year. It puts him in a weird middle ground since he's the kind of guy who has value even if he's not closing. But you put him around 10, you think that's a good number?
Yeah, I was going to say even a dozen. You know, I figured maybe about eight before Chapman returns and then just kind of picks up he'll probably pick the odd one up along the way. I was kind of thinking if the Yankees generate about 45 saves this season, you know, maybe he gets about a dozen, Betances gets one or two just randomly, and, you know, Chapman gets a little over 30, so, or around 30. So I think a dozen. I mean, Miller's a must-use in every league at the beginning of the year. I mean, his perfect role is paired with Chapman, you know, for people who are still drafting, which is most people. But for someone else, you know, who just wants a little saves bump earlier in the year, and then you can kind of rotate him in and out of your lineup the rest of the way because he'll deliver those strong ratios. Like, he's worth owning in all leagues now.
Isn't that kind of a tough spot, though, because I feel like a lot of times if you talk about having both guys, you're talking about taking somebody at the end as a handcuff. You're not really going to take Andrew Miller at the end as a handcuff. It might be kind of tough to get both those guys in a draft and get value. It just seems like a tough spot because you're not probably not – if you have both of them, you're probably taking them both a little earlier than you would want to take both of them. It might be a little – bit of a difficult value proposition, don't you think?
Yeah, the reason I kind of like this one is that Miller is so good at getting strikeouts and giving low ratios that you could have a time once Chapman comes back where you're actually happy to use them both, especially in a deeper mixed league. So it's not like if you were picking a pitcher who you thought, okay, I'll use him in the first 30 games and then I just don't even want him anymore. That, I think, would be hard. The other way I might approach it is if I'm going to get Chapman, I want that discount. So I'm going to maybe value him in my draft outside the top 9 or 10 closers. And if those closers go and he's there and I need a closer, I'm going to take him. And now I feel like I got great value on him. And because I got great value on him, maybe I feel a little comfortable being aggressive on Miller and taking him a round or two before I normally would have. And I say, well, okay, it all kind of comes out in the wash where I got great value on one and maybe not so great value on the other.
And that's reasonable. I can just see it being a tough spot where you've got Chapman and you don't want to go get Miller quite that quickly. But I guess the point is, if you've got Chapman, you probably didn't take him as early as you thought you might before we were thinking about him missing a month.
Yeah, the hard part with Miller, the interesting thing to me with Miller is, you know you're going to get those 30 games with him as a closer, and then that's probably it. So do you like Miller more than, you know, to me he's not in the top 15, but probably even not in the top 18 relievers. But once you get down around 20, it's like, do you like him more than the guys like Steve Cishek who have a closer job, but we don't have a lot of trust in them and they don't provide the ratios? You know, would you rather just have him and know what you're going to get, the dozen saves, the 10 saves, and the great ratios? Or do you want to take the chance on the Cishek type where you could get 40 saves, or you could get terrible ratios and five saves and he loses his job by the beginning of May? It's a really tough call.
There's also a third option, which is if you get Chapman, then you pass on Miller and you wait and do more of a true handcuff kind of thing with Betances late. You say, look, this guy's going to get me a lot of Ks anyway. Maybe some weird things happen and he stumbles into some saves, and maybe maybe that's the other guy you get.
Yeah, for sure, that's worth it. I mean, early in drafts, I've seen Betances going really high. You know, like, I like him, but I've seen people taking him really high and paying a lot for someone who's probably going to get, you know, five wins, a couple saves, but 100 and, you know, 100 and change strikeouts. I thought that he would be discounted because he's kind of third in line there, but people, I haven't seen that so far in drafts. People have been pretty aggressive on him.
Do you differentiate between a guy... Well, actually, Miller might be in the same category, too. Do you differentiate between a guy like, and I'm just talking about innings here, and health, between a guy like Chapman, who has been doing this for a while, and somebody like Betances, who put up a ton of innings last year, and you just don't know if you do it again? I have a hard time shaking with a guy like that who did such an unusual role and was pushed so hard last year. I can't shake a little bit of worry. I'm not saying he's hands off, but I'm saying I bake in a little more risk with somebody like him than with some other guys. Do you see that, or is that just overreaction on my part?
No, I think you're onto a good point. And he's been pushed pretty hard 2 years in a row now, so you wonder if that'll add up at some point. So maybe when you're making your projections, you don't want to pay for that, like for exactly what he's done the past 2 years. Maybe you want to discount that by, you know, 10%, add, you know, 20 or 30 points to his ERA, add 10 or 15 points to his WHIP, you know, take off 10 or 20 strikeouts and say, okay, if I can get him at where I'm expecting that level of production, then I'll take it, but I don't want to totally buy in on him maintaining that really heavy workload and being quite as good, you know, as he has been. And his control was inconsistent last season, so he wasn't perfect last year.
That line on pitchers is always so interesting. When does a guy go from injury risk to horse? When does he go from one of these years it's not going to happen anymore to guess this is who he is? Of course, then maybe you end up with Felix Hernandez, and you're wrong anyway. But
yeah.
So promised rapid fire, and we spent 7 minutes on that. But move on to Ian Desmond joins the Rangers. It's a very weird fit in a lot of ways. I kind of come out thinking almost nobody – fantasy-wise benefits. I mean, Desmond goes to a friendly ballpark, but he also goes from being a shortstop to being an outfielder. It, again, we talked about Joey Gallo. It makes you wonder about Joey Gallo's value. It's an indication that Josh Hamilton probably is, as we've talked about, somebody you would just stay away from entirely. Is there anybody you come out of this liking more than you liked before?
Not really. I guess maybe Desmond to a small degree. He's going to have multi-position eligibility now for this season, which is nice, and this park gives him a good chance to hit 20 homers. That being said, Desmond just really scares me. And I know statistically, like even when I do my rankings, he comes in, you know, somewhere around 7th or 8th among shortstops because of that ability to hit 20 homers and steal about 15 bases. So, you know, I get it. Like, I get the power-speed combo, and you don't have that a lot of shortstops, especially once you get past, Correa and a couple others. So, but, man, he was so bad for so long last year and really inconsistent. If you take out August, he was bad for almost the entire year. So, like, I don't mind. When people are drafting, I'm not saying it's a terrible pick, but he's just someone I just don't think I want to own this year.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I don't see it. I do wonder, you know, selective endpoints are so dangerous. You can kind of frame it where you had a pretty good second half. Does that do anything for you, or do you more look at he really had a good few weeks and the whole thing was, by and large, pretty ugly?
Yeah, that's my concern. He really had a good August. Like, he wasn't good in July. He wasn't really good in September. He was great in August. And I don't know. I feel like if I'm going to draft someone who's inconsistent like that, I want to know that I believe in them and that I see the glasses half full with that player. And with him, I just don't. And when I've been in that situation in the past and I take the player anyways, if they don't have a good year, I feel like I'm kicking myself at the end of April because I'm saying, you know, oh, you saw this coming. You didn't believe in the guy and you took him anyways. I just, with the strikeout rate going up, I just don't know. I'm just not confident in him.
Yeah, I mean, you make an interesting point there, which is, look, we're humans playing this. We're not running programs to determine what we're doing each day. And there's some element of, you have to believe in this guy. You just have to – there are some guys you believe that he's going to come through and some you don't, and eventually you're going to make some decisions that are really fine. And part of that's going to be, do I want to hold on to this guy because I think he's going to do it versus I don't. I think that's some of these times, as much as you want to try to be rational, sometimes you need to account for the fact that you're not going to be rational as the season goes on.
Yeah, and I'm okay with anyone just taking – 10, 20 names off their draft list before the draft starts. You know, and just saying, you know, on these particular players, I don't want to own them this year. I don't feel good about them. I wouldn't be surprised if they had a disastrous season. So even if the numbers kind of indicate they're a little bit better than someone else when it's my turn, I don't want to be tied to them. I think I'm pretty rational when it comes to fantasy baseball and pretty systematic with it. But sometimes I think it's okay to do that because in the end, you do have to believe in your team.
Yeah. Moving down the list, the Dodgers, you could almost have a weekly Dodgers-only, fantasy-only podcast with the number of pieces they have, the number of stuff going, amount of stuff going on. There's something on our list here, and now there's something else today. Ryu's going to start the year on the DL. Now Brett Anderson is going to miss 3 to 5 months. To me, and the guy you note on here, and to me the guy that this raises the value of and makes me very interested in is Alex Wood. You just can't chase Alex Wood off. He keeps getting opportunities, and thus far he has yet to fail at one. Is it time to once again say, yeah, you know what? Alex Wood's a guy probably you want to have on your team.
Yeah, I'm fine with Alex Wood, you know, kind of in the second half of a 10 or 12 team draft. I think he's going to make 30 starts now. It just seems like for some reason the Dodgers can't get, you know, everything to line up in their rotation, right? Like last year they had to dip really deep into their depth to try to cover starts, and it seems like we're already on the path for that this year. So, you know, but thinking fantasy-wise, you know, I like Wood as maybe like a fifth-type starter in a 10 or 12-team league, maybe even fourth. I'd say more fifth to me. And I like Ryu actually now as a guy you stash on your disabled list at the start of the year and you don't expect to use him until maybe the beginning of June. You know, when he pitches, he's, like in his pro career, he's done quite well. So now you can probably get him basically in the last round of your draft or maybe even pluck him off waivers in shallow leagues after your draft and then put him straight into the DL slot. I like that better than investing a lot in him, you know, a month ago and expecting 175 innings.
Is there anybody else in Dodger land that all this uncertainty kind of bumps up for you? Anybody else you've got an eye on beyond Wood that you say, maybe he's in my picture now?
Not really yet. I mean, well, I think we'll have to wait now because the Anderson news, like as we're recording, just came out in the last hour, and we'll have to see who the Dodgers are leaning towards as far as that fifth starter at the beginning of the season, and do they go with, you know, Mike Bolsinger, who's, you know, fine, but not really someone who's going to get people in a standard mixed league excited, or are they going to look at some other options?
We continue to head down. Let's see, I told you it would be relatively rapid fire.
We're moving quicker
now. We just
now.
Had to get there. The Marlins, we still don't know exactly what's up with Carter Capps. It certainly doesn't sound good. He's going to see Dr. Andrews. Now, my friend Will Carroll has repeatedly emphasized that's not inherently bad news. Dr. Andrews is a really good doctor, and you'd like to hear what he has to say, but you also don't go to get a second opinion if there's not something worrisome in the first opinion as a general rule. So we'll probably know a lot more about Carter Capps by the next time we talk, but I think you made a good point, which is that even if he's healthy, even if this isn't surgery and out for the year, it would seem that there's a closer competition here, and he came in as the second guy. Pretty hard to imagine him taking over at this point, really at any point in the season, unless something happens to Ramos, and even then. I guess the point is, Ramos seems a lot more secure now, correct?
Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, Capps was shaping up as a really good sleeper. You know, with his strikeout ability, you know, he could have been a top-tier closer pretty close if he won the job and was healthy. But, I mean, you add up everything, the initial arm soreness this season, the trip to see Dr. Andrews already, being shut down at the end of last year. It just, you know, seems to be all trending in the wrong direction. And Ramos is a good enough pitcher now where I would assume that he's just the closer. Capps isn't. If Capps is even able to pitch, you know, he's setting up. And I don't think Ramos is a high candidate to lose the job. So now I think you probably just let Capps fall the waivers if you're drafting, you know, in a mixed league. It's too bad, but I think this is the direction it's going. I just don't see how you see Dr. James Andrews on March 7th, which is when he's scheduled, and then less than a month later, you've beaten out A.J. Ramos and you're the opening day closer. It just doesn't seem to add up.
Right. It's the beating out key part that's as much for our conversation, for our purposes, that's as key as anything, that this is not a job he has that someone would have to beat him for. It's a job he doesn't have, and it's hard to see how he gains it, even if he gets a relatively clean bill, even if they say just shut it down for a couple of weeks. Moving down the line, we're going to talk a little bit of lineups here. We don't really know what much of anybody's lineup is going to look like for sure right now, but we're starting to get some looks. stay with the Marlins first. It looks like Giancarlo Stanton is going to bat fourth, at least as of now. Justin Bour will be the guy hitting behind him, and maybe Marcelo Ozuna second. What does that do, really, for any of those guys, but especially Bour and Ozuna, a couple of interesting guys? Do those positions affect how you value them?
Not so much for Bour, but it makes me a little more interested in Ozuna just because it could, if he stays in that, you know, two-hole all season, it can prop up his run scored total. I mean, if you figure if he stays there all season and plays respectively, he should be able to score a minimum of 75 runs and maybe even 85 runs. So, you know, that to me, if you're thinking of him as a sleeper and you're hoping he gets back to the 20-homer level, like, I like him a lot better hitting second than hitting, like, seventh. And we talked about last week a little bit about the difference between, say, fantasy value and fit for a player. We've talked about that with Jonathan Scope a little bit. Like, if they had Ozuna hitting sixth or seventh, like, I could see maybe the 20 homers, but maybe he doesn't get the rest of the counting stats you need. Now I kind of like the chances for him to both drive in and score runs.
I came into this spring really, well, and not that we're far into spring, but I came into this year when I started looking at teams, I was really down on the Marlins. And I see more and more people interested in them, and I start putting that lineup together, and I still don't know that it's deep enough, but I look at that lineup, and if it goes something like Gordon, Ozuna, Yelich, Stanton, that's pretty good at the top. I mean, if nothing else, Stanton's not a guy that you dock because there's nobody hitting in front of him. I mean, he's a guy, you know, unlike we talked about Freddie Freeman last week, there's not a lot there even if you like Freddie Freeman's health. If Stanton's healthy, there's an opportunity for him to drive in some runs there. Is what do you think of this top half of this Marlins lineup? I mean, it's a pretty good lineup for the guys who are in it.
Yeah, it's not bad. And if there's a reason the Marlins can't compete this year, I think it'll actually be more their back end of their pitching staff, because and even you look like after Stanton, you have Bour, and then you can have Prado, who's not the worst hitter, like he's okay, and you have Real Muto, who had a decent rookie season. So now we've gone all the way down to seven hitters, and in the National League, that's pretty good. So, I think this maybe also, you're right, on top of talking about Ozuna specifically or Bour specifically, maybe it makes us a little more optimistic that Stanton, if he stays healthy, could have like a top three fantasy season this year.
If Yelich is a three hitter, what does that do for him for you?
Yeah, I'm quite interested in him. Just I want to see a little bit of change in approach. He needs to hit the ball in the air a little bit more so he can hit more home runs, and that's going to drive some of his fantasy value. But, you know, he can hit for average, and to me, I think maybe he's now him hitting third in that lineup. I can't see him as, like, your second-best outfielder in a standard mixed league, but I could see him now as your third-best outfielder, and you're hoping for 20 steals, you know, a 300-ish average, plenty of runs in RBIs, and then maybe you hope for, you know, a dozen homers or maybe 15 homers would be nice.
Elsewhere in lineup land, we look at the Blue Jays, who are another team where you know who's going to be at the heart and you sort of don't know what goes around them. We've learned that Troy Tulowitzki will not be leading off. He didn't really want it. He didn't really like it. He probably is going to hit fifth or so, which leaves apparently Kevin Pillar or Michael Saunders, who are two really different players at the top of the order. Pillar's an interesting guy. I can't shake some skepticism about what he'll do again with the bat, and I can't shake a lot of skepticism about him as a leadoff guy just from baseball terms. But if Pillar's hitting leadoff, he comes onto the radar in that lineup, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean that's probably the best lineup in baseball. And then, you know, you're right. Like, as a leadoff hitter, I don't love the fit with just his on-base skills, but he's really heavily campaigned to get that role. It seems like no one else really wants it on the club. Saunders, I mean, is probably his goal is just try to stay healthy. I don't see how they put him in such a prominent role at the start of the year. They could, but I just don't see it. So, you know, if he's hitting leadoff, even with his poor on-base skills, hitting in front of Donaldson, Batista, and Encarnacion, like, he could score 90 runs. That would boost his fantasy value. The question is whether he could steal 25 bases hitting there or whether they're going to just give him the red light and have him, you know, not be quite as aggressive in front of all those great hitters. If he adds from last season 15 or 20 runs, but then, you know, takes away half a dozen steals, then maybe the net effect is just a wash. But I like the potential.
How much does it worry you? I guess let me put that another way. How confident are you that he stays in that? As you note, like, he's just not a classic leadoff guy by any means. If Saunders is the guy I could see playing himself into that role, I have sort of a long-standing interest in Saunders. I haven't given up on him. I still think there's a really good year or two in him. I don't know if he's going to be healthy, but let's say that Pilar comes to opening day and Blue Jays say, Pilar is our leadoff hitter. Even then, are you still a little skeptical that it stays that way just because his skill set is such a weird fit for the leadoff spot?
Yeah, for sure, a little bit. I mean, there is the option of Devin Travis later in the season, but Travis is someone that really worries me. Like, his shoulder injury just isn't going away, and the timelines just get pushed back and back and back, and I just am not optimistic that he'll be able to have a really healthy stretch even once he gets back, or that he'll get back when people are hoping he'll get back. Maybe he will, but this seems to be an injury that just won't clear itself up. So, you know, Saunders kind of seems to be the competition unless they get to the point where it's July and they're, you know, winning the division and thinking far ahead and decide to trade for another Ben Revere type like they did last year to put at the top of the lineup. So, you know, I mean, but that's for fantasy perspective. I'm thinking pretty far ahead. I think if he's the opening day leadoff hitter, you have to assume that he could hold that role for like half, unless he gets off to a really slow start, just because no one else seems to want it. I like the on-base skills of Russell Martin, for example, as a fit at the top of their lineup, but I get the theory of maybe not wanting that high workload catcher also hitting leadoff.
Yeah, and you know, Travis, not to go too far on a tangent here, but it's one of those personal things. When hitters have front shoulder issues, it just scares me permanently, and that's a specific thing for me. I covered Scott Rolen, and I remain convinced that if Scott Rolen doesn't blow up his shoulder, he's going to the Hall of Fame. He damaged his front shoulder and was just never the same player again. I really hope that's not the case with Devin Travis. I love him as a player. I liked him at Florida State. He's been a favorite of mine for a while, but hitter's front shoulder is just one of those things. It's like even more than a wrist, it's just one of those things that scares me like forever.
Yeah, not all injuries are, you know, are the same. And front shoulders for hitters, you know what I mean? Like certain things for certain positions and certain skill sets. And he's someone we have a very small sample size on anyways. I've seen a lot of people really tout him as a mixed league sleeper this season. I'm just not convinced that he's worth that DL stash because I don't know when he'll be back and what you'll get from him.
Yeah, and that's the other thing with him is we have – he was so much better than anybody expected. This was not – the Blue Jays, I don't think, expected that he was going to be as good as he was when they got him. So you'd be, even if he were healthy, I think you'd be a little skeptical as to whether he could repeat what he did last year.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Moving on down this list, hey, talking about Scott Rolen, we're going to talk about Albert Pujols. Maybe we can wedge Jim Edmonds in here somewhere later. Albert Pujols sounds like he's going to be, he thinks he's going to be healthy and ready for opening day. How much value does Pujols have at this point as a guy who doesn't hit for average anymore, probably is going to hit some home runs, is not in that great of a lineup, Mike Trout aside? What kind of value does Pujols have for you?
Yeah, to me, the news that he's going to be ready for opening day puts him now into those top 12 first basemen. And when we did the first base podcast about a month ago, we had him just outside that group because of the concern he started the year on the DL. I see him in that group now, but he worries me a bit, and I think he's going to be overdrafted now with news that he's going to be ready for the start of the season, or should be. I think certain numbers really attract fantasy owners, and one of those big numbers is the 40 homers. You know, when we see 40 homer player, and he hit that last year, but I don't think of him as a 40 homer player, especially coming off an inconsistent offseason at his age, and as you said, he's not hitting for average, and the lineup doesn't look great. To me, he's like the 11th or 12th first baseman, and I think he's going to be drafted much higher than that. You covered him for a long time. Is he someone you would be willing to really target and expect 35 homers this year, or would you be a little more tentative than that?
I couldn't. And my theory on Pujols has been for a while, he played through so much when he was at his peak. The injuries and pain that guy played through were ridiculous. I mean, he still played with a completely wrecked elbow for 12 years now. The amount of stuff he played through, my sort of unsubstantiated theory is that it's just taken its toll, that he put himself through so much and played through so much that he's kind of just beaten up. If I give you 30 as an over-under for Pujols, and that's a number he's topped once in Anaheim. If I give you 30 as an over-under for Pujols' home runs this year, what are you taking?
I'm going to take the under. And one of the reasons I'm worried that he really worries me is I hate to bank on a repeat of a year, not just of great production, but where the production was really bunched. And people who maybe don't pay attention quite as closely as we do might forget that, like, a lot of his power production was bunched in about a 4 to 6 week period during the first half of last season. And if you take that period out, he's a good power hitter, but nothing like his final numbers indicate.
One other thing I do want to ask what you think about Pujols, though, because I think this is interesting and weird. He hasn't hit even 290 since 2011, and yet he also hasn't struck out even 80 times in any of those years. I don't entirely know what to do with that, but it is strange to me that a guy with the ability to hit for the kind of power he still has, who still takes a good at-bat, who doesn't strike out, is not hitting for higher average. I haven't delved into some of the exit velocity and some of that kind of stuff, but when you see that, does it make you think that maybe, just playing devil's advocate here, maybe there is still some chance for him to get back to a 270, 280 kind of range?
Yeah, well, I guess you're right. I guess it's possible. Now, one thing to throw into that is his walk rate isn't what it used to be. So I don't know if maybe he's just, you know, putting the ball, like making sure he continues to put the ball in play and doesn't strike out, but isn't really making, and like you said, with his exit velocity and everything, like maybe he's just not making the same amount of hard contact that he used to. Yeah, I don't know. I just, once we see for a player his age that batting average go down and not really come back up for a couple of years, I usually just assume that that's where we're at, whether we can find an easy explanation or not.
Yeah, absolutely. One more name that we wanted to check on, Tyler Duffy, apparently going to be in the rotation. Are you buying or are you skeptical?
I'm buying with, like, my last round pick in a standard league. I owned Tyler Duffy in some leagues late last season, and he was pretty solid. He's not dominating, but he was pretty solid. And I know when they first brought him up last year, you know, people familiar with the Twins organization said, like, okay, this kid could do okay in the majors. You know, nobody's projecting him to be an ace. Like, I don't mind him enough to take him. I take him in the last round or last couple rounds and start him maybe on my bench and see where we're at. But I'm not reaching for him. He doesn't have to be part of my rotation. Is he someone you would want in, say, like a 12-team league?
I would not be in any hurry to go get him. Here's my thought. If I were to say to you, I'm going to go with extreme skepticism for fantasy purposes for every pitcher who comes out of the Twins system until one of them shows he can actually strike people out at a high rate. Do you think I'm wrong? Is that a bad stance to take?
No, I think it's actually a fine stance to take, unless you get to a pitcher who's just so overwhelmingly good, you know, with taken first or second overall, and you know, you think he's just an anomaly. But no, I think that's a fine stance to take. You're right. In recent years, I just haven't invested heavily in any Twins pitchers, or haven't gotten really optimistic. Like, Kyle Gibson's not someone I'm chasing this year. He's in the same group to me. Like, I'll own him and spot start him if he comes really late in a draft, but I'm not expecting a big jump or anything. And that's kind of where I'm at with Duffy, where, you know, like, he was good enough late last season and in the minors that I could see a sub-4 ERA, so then, like, I'll take him late, but I don't see the kind of ratios to survive a mediocre strikeout rate and be in my lineup all the time.
Just until, again, as you know, one of these days maybe they come into somebody, but until somebody proves me wrong, it's pretty clear there's an organizational philosophy here that's a bit like Bull Durham. Strikeouts are fascist. Like, they really don't look for guys who overpower hitters. They don't look for guys who miss bats. It does not seem to be something that organization values, and so I sort of feel like even guys who might have some of that skill, it doesn't seem to be something they emphasize. And so, again, as we were both saying, until somebody proves me wrong coming out of there, I'm going to miss the first guy who proves people wrong coming out of organization. And maybe I'll get the second one, but I'm going to miss the first one.
Yeah, and that all comes back to, you know, there's no one player you need to win your league, right? Like, if you happen to miss on a guy who, you know, defies the odds and becomes a high strikeout Twin starter, it's not going to cost you winning your league. You don't have to hit on all these options. You know, you want to pick the ones you feel most comfortable with, and I think it's fine. You know, people ask, in a more extreme example, they'll say to me, like, would you ever own a Rocky starter? And my answer is, in a mixed league, basically never. And maybe I'll miss one some year, someone will put together a nice season, and that's okay, because the guy who owns my league probably won't win the league, you know, that year anyway. So you can have those general philosophies, and if you miss the odd guy, it's not going to ruin your league.
And by the way, I lied. We do have one more before we get to outfielders, and that is Jerrod Dyson, who will be out. We're now saying 4 to 6 weeks because of an oblique strain. This is another one of those where my time on the beat colors the way I view it. I just never buy, and this is not to do with any one organization, I never buy the minimum on oblique strains. Those things are tricky. You always want to give it more time. If a guy does come back quickly from an oblique, it makes me skeptical he's going to hurt it again. It makes me nervous when you're dealing with something that at this point. Look, maybe it's nothing. Maybe it goes away quickly. Maybe he's the exception. But obliques are things that make me say, I don't really want any piece of that. Which is unfortunate because Dyson is a guy who looked to be in for more of an opportunity. He might have been a really interesting guy. With the increased role once he's back, but the injury, how do you value him right now?
Yeah, to me, he's like a late-round pick. He's someone you target if you didn't draft a lot of steals. He always was that. Now you can get him a little cheaper. Maybe you can get them at a nice discount. I was ready to go out on a limb and predict him to lead the American League in steals this year. I was hoping 400 at-bats, maybe even 420 at-bats, and he steals over 40 bases, and no one stole 40 in the AL last year. So, you know, I felt like he could lead the league in steals. I guess it's still possible, right? Like, we've got about 4 weeks till opening day, so if he comes in, if he misses 2 or even 3 weeks of the season, he could still come in and steal 35 bases and be right there for tops in the AL. To me, he's really, really valuable in an AL-only league as opposed to in a mixed league, because in a mixed league, you can tap into a lot of the other base stealers in the National League, but there's not a lot of steals to go around in the AL right now.
I amuse myself by how much I harp on batting average, since as a lifelong stat head, I'm somebody who has often talked about how it doesn't really matter, but fantasy is another matter, and baseball in 2016, getting hits is a skill that's more valuable than ever. I guess in AL only, you don't even worry about the average, but in the mixed league, you know, this is a guy who's never hit higher than 269. He's never had a full-time opportunity, but he's had 250, 300 bats in recent years. How does that affect you? Do you just hold on to the idea that maybe he plays more, he gets more hits, or do you just say, look, I can live with 250 from an outfielder because I need those steals really badly?
Yeah, no, you draft him paying for 250, and you hope you're pleasantly surprised or at least not that disappointed. And, yeah, he's part of an overall team plan, either a plan made before an auction, for example, or a draft, or a plan kind of hatched during it where you come out of your early rounds with just a lot of sluggers and you think, you know, I have to make up these steals some way, and I don't want to draft, you know, 2 or 3 20 base steal type guys. I'm going to take Dyson. I'm going to hope for the 35 steals. I'm going to live with the batting average because I need the steals that bad, and I'm going to accept that he's the one guy in my lineup who basically won't contribute in other areas.
We now move on to outfielders, and tier one is, it's almost not worth talking about just because we've talked about it several times before. It's two guys who are alone at the top, so I will let people know you have Bryce Harper and Mike Trout. We have addressed that question at length. So let's go straight to tier two here. It's a mix of guys who I feel like some are high risk and some are high floor. And so I guess my question is, when you're drafting that high, does your first pick affect it? Does general philosophy, what determines whether you are more in the camp of a high floor guy like a McCutcheon, like a Batista, versus a guy who the ceiling is insane, like Stanton or Mookie Betts, but you worry in Betts' case about repeating and Stanton's case about health? The fifth guy you have in that group is Pollock, but I'm curious as to what you think, just as a philosophical question, how you make that determination between those guys who are really high floor and you'd be shocked if they weren't very good, and the guys who you say, this is risky, but boy, if he hits, I've got something special.
Yeah, I would like to chase the high ceiling guy who I believe in. Coming back to something we talked about, you know, earlier in the podcast, like if I believe in Stanton, if I believe this is the year he stays healthy, I mean, I think that's the only obstacle for him. If he's healthy, he's really valuable. And with Betts, we're not worried about injuries, but you're right, some people could be worried about regression. If I'm a Betts believer and he's a high ceiling guy, then that's where I'd like to go. I mean, we saw with McCutcheon last year, a lot of people drafted him because he was the high floor guy. And then he had a disappointing year, and his floor wasn't really that high. Like, he wasn't one of, say, the 20 or 25 best hitters last year. He wasn't terrible, but he was a little disappointing, and he did hurt people who took him in the top 5, for example. So even when you're chasing that high floor, like, you just, I think we always think of what the floor is, and it's just not always the floor. Like, could you see Jose Bautista having a regression this year at his age? I mean, I guess of course you could, and he should be a high floor guy. He's been great every year for a few years now.
No, that's a good point. And Bautista is one guy that you probably are a little less confident in the floor on, just because of the age, because he's not necessarily a high average guy. If Jose Bautista hit 230 this year, you'd be disappointed, you'd be surprised, but you wouldn't be shocked. It wouldn't be inconceivable for him to have some fall off at this point. So yeah, I think that's a good point. The other guy in there that I still, even now, am really not entirely sure what to do with is AJ Pollock. I mean, he is coming off a really tremendous year, but it was his first time getting even 500 plate appearances. And he never profiled really as that guy in the minors. He certainly hit some. He was a first-round pick. He was an intriguing guy. But I can't shake – I'll put it this way. He's one of those guys that I'm not avoiding entirely, but I'm sure not rushing. I'm not going to beat somebody else to him. If he's sitting around, I'll take him. But I'm just skeptical that he does it again. Tell me I'm wrong, or tell me that maybe you see where I'm coming from.
No, I see where you're coming from, and I don't love the Diamondbacks lineup, and you know, and that stuff does matter to me when we're talking about early round picks. I've had the late pick in some 15 team leagues already this year, and he kind of comes right in that decision making time, and I've decided that I would rather go with Betts or McCutcheon. I'd just rather take a chance on that McCutcheon gets back to that top five status he had prior to last season, or that Betts continues to ascend, than to guess that Pollock will be, you know, that good again this year. And I know he could have a very slight regression and still be worth a late first-round pick, but to me, the combination of the regression concerns, the fact that he's only put together one monster season, and the fact that I just don't love – I love Goldschmidt, obviously, but not the rest of that lineup. You know, Segura, not a high on-base percentage guy, maybe up near the top with him, and I don't like the bottom half of the lineup. Yeah, it's enough to make me think he's a second-round pick and not a first-round pick.
So we move to Tier 3, and again, another wide range of guys. A guy that really jumps out to me from this group, and I will read them so people know: George Springer, Starling Marte, Charlie Blackmon, Ryan Braun, J.D. Martinez, Lorenzo Cain, Nelson Cruz, and Justin Upton. Actually, two guys in there that jump out at me, and one is George Springer. I like Springer a lot, and I could definitely see him making that jump a lot closer to Tier 2. Are you buying on him? What's your worry on him? What do you see when you look at Springer?
Yeah, no, I'm excited about Springer, but you know, he's maybe Tier 3's version of Stanton, where we see this massive upside, but just hasn't all come together. And maybe he's even more so to that point, which is why he's down in Tier 3. Like, I'm excited about him. At the same time, it's hard to get too high in the projections for a guy who just hasn't done it yet over a full season. And that's kind of where I'm at with him. I mean, he's someone who, if he hit 25 homers and stole 25 bases this year, we wouldn't be shocked. And if he had 300 at-bats this year and spent some more time on the disabled list, we wouldn't be shocked either. So I'm excited. At the same time, it's hard to turn down, and this is where the dilemma is. You know, it's hard to turn down Charlie Blackmon or J.D. Martinez, who could flirt with 40 homers this year, for someone who hasn't had that big year yet. You know, he's in that tier because we see he could easily be in Tier 2, but he has that more disappointing potential, maybe.
What's the worry beyond health, though? Because let's just say he doesn't take a step forward at all from last year. Let's say that he puts basically the same rates, but he just does it in 50% more plate appearances. He played 102 games last year. Let's give him 150. 24 homers, 24 steals, hit 276, 90 runs. If you're just projecting this stuff out, now the RBI don't look good if you do this a little quick and dirty, but I guess what I'm saying is I don't really worry about anything but health with him. Is health that big a worry, or do you worry even that maybe he's not even as good as he was in 100 games last year?
No, I'm not really worried about, you know, a big per game decline. For me, it would be the health such other attractive, plentiful options at the time and at that point in your draft. We're talking like round two in some drafts and round three or four in others. So, yeah, it would just be the worry of the health and then all those other options, and maybe you just opt for someone else and let someone else take a chance on them. Other than that, though, I think, you know, you're right. The RBI total last year was low. I know he did spend some time at the top of the lineup. I just can't see him with Altuve and Correa, I can't see that trio, if they're all healthy, not being productive.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I look at him. But, hey, I hope more people agree with you, and I can get him a little later than I have to, though I know in our office league we won't. But that's neither here nor there. The other guy in that group that really intrigues me is Justin Upton. Justin Upton is the same age within 4 months as A.J. Pollock. They were both born in the second half of 1987, and Justin Upton has 190 big league home runs, 115 big league steals, is coming off a year where he hit 26 homers, stole 19 bases. While playing in San Diego, he now goes to a much friendlier park. I know the reputation is not for that in Detroit, but Comerica is a pretty decent place to hit, certainly a lot better than San Diego. I really like Justin Upton, and this is weird to say, as almost a sleeper. I like him as a guy that people may sort of be down on, that I could see having a huge year. Where are you taking Justin Upton?
Yeah, no, I feel good about him, and he's one of my preferred options in that tier. I feel good that we will see roughly 30 homers. I like him hitting second in the lineup, which looks where he's going to go for the run scored. I think his batting average will be not awesome, but not terrible. And it wouldn't shock me if some year he did put together a higher batting average, even with the strikeouts. He's so inconsistent, though, within the year that just never seems to happen. I guess my big concern with him will just be, how much does he get to run if he's batting right in front of Miguel Cabrera? And does he run at a point where he gets 10 steals, or does he run to the point where he gets 20? And that is a pretty big factor with there not being a lot of steals out there this season.
No, that's a good point. Is there anybody else from that group that you particularly like that you would say maybe you have an eye on more than others?
I seem to end up with Lorenzo Cain on a decent amount of my teams. I don't think I'm maybe super high on him. I feel like a lot of people in the industry are expecting a big regression this year, and I'm really not, because I just feel like he can basically do what he did last year all over again. I even look at his RBI total from last year, which is low 70s. I feel like someone who hits 300 and hits anywhere around 15 homers and hits third on a good team like the Royals should be able to drive in more than, 72 runs. So I find I end up with him more because I feel like, to me, Kane is in the middle of that tier. And to other people, I found that they kind of maybe don't even have him in that tier or have him at the very tail end.
Your next group, as we look here, Carlos Gomez, Adam Jones, Hunter Pence, Yoenis Cespedes. What do you do with Gomez? He even when he played, wasn't that great last year. The steals were down some. The power was down some. Gomez in his age 29 season just was not the same player he was in his age 27 and 28 seasons. He's still in a friendly ballpark. He's still got all those tools. He's not old. But are you worried about Gomez?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, this tier is the tier of bounce backs. I mean, not Cespedes, but him, Jones, Pence, and, which one do you believe in to get back to their pre-2015 glory? For me, with Gomez, I felt like when Gomez had those two great years, we were all a little surprised. Like, we knew he could be a good player, but not to that degree. And now when he came crashing back down, I think now it has a second guessing more than, say, someone like a McCutcheon, who I know wasn't as disappointing as Gomez, but we all believe in McCutcheon, so we believe he'll come right back quite quickly. Now I think with Gomez, you're starting to see two groups of people. You're seeing people who say, I never really totally believed in that guy in the first place, so I'm out. And then you're seeing other people who did believe in him who are saying, no, I think he can come back. To me, I say I'm out enough that I probably won't own him on a team. I'm not willing to go back to more than 20 homers and more than 30 steals. I'll take the under on both those totals, not by much, but by enough that probably someone else will end up drafting him in my league.
You mentioned Jones as a bounce-back guy, and to some extent that's true, but I'm looking at his line here. He was awfully similar in 14 and 15. His 14 and 15 were more alike than they were like the previous 2 years. Now, Adam Jones is certainly not old. He's certainly not necessarily in decline, but this is his age 30 season. He's played a lot. I sort of have a notion that maybe rather than a bounce back guy, this is what he is. He's now merely a rather good player, a durable player, certainly a key part of the Orioles, but 25, 27, 29 kind of 80 or 90 RBI, 260, 270 or 270, 280 even. 10 steals total the last 2 years. I mean, look, it's only 2 years, and it's not a career death sentence, but I'm not sure I'm buying that Jones is coming back. I think maybe this is the player he is right now.
Yeah, and I mean, Jones is a good example of how someone can go from round one in drafts to round four through very slight changes. I mean, the things that we're concerned about coming, when we say coming back, like, are the steals coming back? Because he used to be someone who would get you double-digit steals, and then that stopped in 2014, and then it really stopped when he got three last year. So is he like a three-steal guy now, or is he still maybe a 10-steal guy, and that does matter? And the other thing is he, you mentioned he's been really durable, and then last year, late in the season, he struggled with nagging injuries, you know, played in fewer games, the rate of production fell off late in the year. So are we willing to give him that durable tag back, or is now he just more of a regularly durable guy and not getting a, kind of a plus in that category? Tim, you're right. I think he's a high 20s, you know, homer, a 90-ish RBI guy who hits 270 or 280. That spells kind of round four or five in a roto, in a standard roto draft, you know, and he was going in round one or two in the previous years.
All right, well, we need to be wrapping up soon, and Tier 5 is very long, so there are two guys in there that I want to ask. There's a lot of guys I want to ask you about, but one of them we talked about Yelich. I want to ask you about Puig and about Jason Hayward, who in some ways are exact opposites, but they're both guys we don't really know what we're going to get and could be really special. Do you still have some superstar hope for Puig, or is he now, at this point, a guy that maybe you sort of don't even hope for that?
Yeah, I totally get why someone would go out and draft Puig fairly high in a league this year. I see the superstar potential. To me, my stance on Puig comes back to maybe something we talked about with the Twins pitchers earlier, where I can be wrong on Puig and still win my league. So I'm just not going to be the guy who owns Puig this year. I'm not going to project him for, you know, 25 home runs and 20 steals in this monster year that we do know he's probably capable of if he puts it all together. It's just not going to be me this year, and I'll let someone else take that chance, and I just will take players that I view as safer. For some reason, I do view Hayward as safer, and I know he's been disappointing, but I feel like when Hayward's disappointing, he's only mildly disappointing, if that makes any sense. And we're still waiting for the breakout, but what we've been getting along the way is okay. Like, it's enough to, you know, to make him still quite useful. So for that reason, I'm interested in Hayward, although I'm still waiting to see exactly how that Cubs lineup's going to shake out.
Yeah, he's done it in so many different ways. He sort of gets to the same level of production a whole lot of different ways, but I got to like the idea he's going to score more runs this year, and he's such a good base stealer that he doesn't even need to run a lot to get you a lot of steals. He can run 25 times and get you 22 steals. That's a nice thing to have.
Yeah, I mean, the shortest way I could probably summarize it, I feel like Hayward's going to be great or good, and I feel like Puig could be great or terrible. And, you know, and maybe there's an in-between in Puig, but I don't feel like Hayward will be terrible. So if I, for example, decide between those two guys, I would strongly lead Hayward just for that reason. I feel like there's a higher floor, especially, on, like I just mentioned, on that stacked lineup.
All right. Well, that's Fantasy 411. Thanks, everybody, for listening. He's Fred Zinke. I'm Matthew Leach. What say we do this again in a week?